Welcome, everyone, joining us here tonight on the Kings County Radio Club's Technical Question and Answer Net. I am Roy, AC2GS, and I will be your net control operator for this informal net. I will be your host, and Milan KG2C will be your co-host on this exploration into amateur radio technology. The purpose of this net is to provide a platform for discussion and to offer our answers, as well as promote a conversation among all participants of this net. The club maintains an archive of these technical nets on its web pages. Also, we offer original articles and reviews on many topics covered during these technical nets. We also publish technical puzzles for our participants to ponder and as a starting off point to discuss important technical concepts. Tonight's TechNet puzzle is posted on our club website. The link can be found on the front pages of our website in orange-colored type. But if you would like a simple URL to find it, you can just type puzzle.kc2rc.com. Also, we will be offering a streaming service for those who cannot receive our repeater signal. Just point your browser to live.kc2rc.com or stream.kc2rc.com. This net is scheduled for the second and fourth Wednesday of each month. All of this information can also be found on our club website, www.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club. An application is available on our website. No question is too simple. No question is dumb. All wisdom begins with the asking of questions. If you have a question, it deserves to be answered. Our format tonight will be to ask for participants to check in only if they have questions or comments for this net. Please give us your name, your call sign, and whether you have a question or a comment. The net will then address each question in order. I will try my best to provide an answer, and Milan KG2C will join in. If any other listener has any further facts or opinions, they will be free to break in with the word comment, and when recognized, offer their knowledge or experience to us all. If anyone has any suggestions for future topics of interest, please let us know here or use our email address, tech@kc2rc.com. And now I would like to introduce my co-host for this net, Milan KG2C. Good evening, Milan. Milan, are you out there? Okay, perhaps something has delayed Milan. Let me open the TechNet tonight and ask for call signs and first names, and put your name on the list, and we'll get to your question in order.
A2JVX, Lloyd.
Lloyd recognized, and thank you, Lloyd. For a second, I was wondering whether my radio was working anymore. Anyone else want to check in to the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net tonight?
Kilo Yankee 2, Michael Yankee, Gene from Greater and Brooklyn.
Very good. Gene recognized. Anyone else want to check in tonight to the Kings County Radio Club's Technical Net? Okay, so Lloyd, you're first up. What's your question tonight, Lloyd?
Statement first, if that's okay.
That's fine with me.
I don't think you should feel bad because you're competing with the Olympics.
Hey, sirrah, sirrah. You pick your poison. We'll be here next week and the week, well, we'll be here in 2 weeks and two more weeks, so we will survive even the Olympics.
My question is, when you work a satellite, you have to account on the uplink for the Doppler shift. How come we don't have to account for Doppler shift when you're mobile and moving at a great rate of speed, and then connecting to a repeater when you could be moving away from that repeater or laterally to that repeater or towards that repeater doesn't require any Doppler correction back to net?
Okay, dokie. Well, I can pretty much give you two particular reasons for that. One is you're not traveling anything close to the speed of a satellite that's in orbit around the Earth. So it's a matter of velocity. But in addition to velocity, it also has a lot to do with frequency modulation. Frequency modulation has a rather broad capture bandwidth. And so you can be off by a few hundred cycles. I mean, if you have nothing better to do someday, tune into a repeater any place that's active and twirl the knob and see how far you have to go before you lose the signal.
try that.
Yes, FM is incredibly forgiving. Amplitude modulation is reasonably forgiving because it has its own built-in carrier. The mode that really gets you into trouble is single sideband, which is a carrierless transmission. You have to inject your own carrier. So if you get the frequency wrong, that's where it sounds like either you're talking to a bunch of guys who have really good baritone voices or they've been sniffing helium. But as far as FM, there is no such thing as that. If you go far enough off of the center frequency, you'll it'll deteriorate into noise and then nothingness. You'll never get any kind of frequency shifting because frequency modulation doesn't operate off frequency like that. But single sideband does.
Okay, copy that. So I am I know Milan is work. You don't work satellites, do you?
No. I never really got into the habit. It requires you to be a fleet on your feet and run outside and point it in the right direction at the right time. And I usually get way too distracted to do things on a timely basis like that.
You know, I was trying it indoors on over the weekend when it was raining, and I didn't make an effort to uplink, but I could hear a satellite through the walls of my apartment. That's kind of neat. And I had a high gain antenna, high gain Yagi, which helped, I'm sure. And I kept it tracked to the satellite precisely, downloading this program for the iPhone and then taping the iPhone to the shaft of the Yagi and then putting it on a tripod that was clamped to a tripod so I could track it with some degree of precision. And I could hear the signal, and it was like AO92, and I heard stations in Florida, which was amazing, coming in over it. Anyway, that's just a matter of interest. Back to net.
AC2GS. No, it's very interesting. It only goes to show you what line of sight means when you can get something into orbit. It means a much bigger line of sight. And so although there's no tower in New York City that you can get to point towards Florida, if you got something that's up there in the sky way high, you can. So it's nice to hear that technology is working the exact way that it's supposed to be working. And that's the whole point of these satellites. Among the telemetry is that it's operated as a time delay relay system between different people, contacting it. So, there are hundreds and hundreds of different ways of expressing yourself in this hobby. I spent a little time doing slow scan television, which is a novelty. There's FT8, which it seems like everyone and their mother is going on FT8. The band is always hopping there, and it's always good to hear about the different techniques and the different aspects of amateur radio that are out there and being used by the participants. And if there's ever a place to kind of coalesce around that concept, it's here on a technical net. So I appreciate your input, Lloyd.
Thank you, and thank you for your efforts on the net. So I guess I'll hand it off to to Gene, the other question.
Okay, we'll go to you, Gene, KY2MY. What is your question for tonight?
It wasn't really a question. It was probably like a show and tell, like get Merlin to get the moon bounce off so we all could learn more about satellite bouncing.
Well, unfortunately, Merlin doesn't seem to have been able to be here with us tonight, but there's a big difference between moon bouncing and satellite bouncing, by thousands of miles.
Okay. I know satellite bouncing is a lot different than moon bouncing, but it's almost the same principle, isn't it? But just different distance.
It's because of the distances and because electromagnetic waves decline by the inverse square rule, it's a lot less power. And so you have sort of two major approaches to moon bouncing that really you don't need to worry about for low Earth orbit satellites. You either have to boost your power and reception enormously, and I know guys who had semi-ridiculous 4x4 or 6x6 arrays of Yagis, and we're running at least a kilowatt or kilowatt and a half to bounce it off the moon. Or these days, what a lot of people rely on are the low-signal digital technology that Joe Taylor has brought us, and they don't really communicate the way Malen is communicating with his satellites on phone. They have to do it through digital programs that Joe Taylor gave us. And both of those moon-bound skies don't really care for the other part. You know, the old-timers say that you need power and arrays of Yagis, and the digital guys say, all I need is a computer, and never the twain shall meet. So it's sort of different. I mean, both of them have something to do with extraterrestrial communication. One is a relay back and forth of a low orbit satellite, and the other is a revolving moon that's distant that you're actually just bouncing the waves passively off of.
Forget it's also the satellite is a repeater in the sky.
Yes, the satellite is an active repeater. The moon is just a surface, which is a passive repeater, if you want to think of it that way. But it's just a passive reflector of signal.
The satellite has an amplifier, and it's retransmitting your signal in a different frequency crossband, and presumably at some higher power.
Did you get a comment?
Comment?
Yes, this is Kilo Delta 2, Kilo Lima November. Just a quick comment. I participated in a moon bounce at Beaumark, which is located in Belmar. They're in Wall Township, New Jersey, near the InfoAge Science Center. And they, using the big dish they've got there, they've got the Tiros satellite dish, which is a rather large dish. I don't know if you've ever seen any photos of it, but it's pretty big. You know, for a dish in New Jersey, they were able to take 250 watts and basically bounce that off the moon, and then you'd get back, I guess, about a tenth of a watt. But the interesting part was, because it takes 250,000 miles to get to the moon, and then 250,000 miles for the signal to come back, that's a round trip of 500,000 miles, so you would transmit something to the moon, and you'd hear back like the last 5 or 10 seconds of whatever it was you were saying, because that's how much lag time's involved, even at light speed. So it's significantly different from talking to a satellite, where it's in low Earth orbit, and it's only basically when it's overhead, only 8 miles away, and it has a repeater in it on top of that. So it is significantly different.
Yes, Brian, I agree with you. I mean, the concept is there that it's extraterrestrial. Both of them are off the planet, but there's a lot of differences between the two. But I would tend to differ with your opinion that there was a tenth of a watt. That's a lot of signal, actually. Radio receivers are designed to detect microwatts of power. That's the beauty of receivers. They have a great deal of gain. So I would be surprised if there was more than 10 or 20 microwatts coming back from the moon.
Very likely, but I was just using that as a point of reference.
Yeah, I mean, only a quarter of a kilowatt is a rather low power for the old-style method, which this sounds like. In the old days, you know, they would just rev it up and go crazy, although I don't know exactly the size and the numbers of that antenna that you're talking about. If it's a highly directional antenna, I guess it could make up for the lower power outage. But, those were the good old days. I mean, nowadays, they're doing it in computers, and some of the old-timers, unfortunately, have a sense that the new guys are cheating with computers. But you know, whatever makes you happy, none of this is really going to change a person's life. It's just a hobby, and it's fun, and I hope everyone who tries each and every method gets pleasure out of it. That's the bottom line. It's not like you need this as a life or death type of situation, as far as I'm aware. Anyway, Gene, KY2MY, any other comments?
No, not really. I appreciate that. It's very, very interesting stuff.
Okay, let me just ask if there's anyone out there who came by and would like to give their call sign, has a question, or has a comment for the Technical Net tonight. We do, as always, have a TechNet puzzle available. So just type in puzzle.kc2rc.com or go to the front page of the club's website and click on the orange link that says puzzle. And it's not too difficult as long as you understand what the terms are involved. It has to do with a concept called return loss. Anyway, until we get to the actual puzzle itself, let me once again ask if there's anyone out there who has any particular questions or comments for the Technical Net tonight.
Kilo Delta 2 Mike Echo November, Barry, located in Brooklyn, with a question.
Yes, Barry, please ask your question.
All right. Thank you, Roy, and good evening to all on the net. I would like to know, what would your recommendations be for someone who's interested in learning and getting into software-defined radios? I don't have any, I don't have a good working knowledge of it, but I'm interested, and I'd like to know what pieces of equipment I would need to buy, what type of software I would need, and things like that, if you could point me in the right direction. KD2MEN, back to you, Roy.
Okay, very good, Barry. I assume you aren't listening to us in December, because in December we did a two-part presentation on software-defined radios. The first episode, we did a overview of what was available and what the state of the technology generally was, and the second episode, we went into details about all the nooks and crannies of the technical aspects of how software-defined radios work. And they still exist. The club website maintains an archive of all of these technical nets. So if you go into either December, the first or the second technical net, you'll hear presentations in both of them that give a decent overview. But, you know, we could answer particular questions that might you might be curious about tonight.
Okay. I'm definitely going to go back and listen to the episodes, the sessions that I missed. What are your thoughts on the ICOM 7300?
AC2GS. ICOM has been very, very successful with the IC7300. It is, in my opinion, a very good initial general-purpose radio that uses a lot of software-defined radio methods in it. It has very good specifications, and it's relatively inexpensive. And so if you were to, say, consider that as your entry-level HF radio that's software-defined, you probably would not go wrong. They also have recently come out with a 7610, I think it is, which is their medium-priced, medium-level radio that some people are somewhat disappointed. They expected them to extend the software-defined radio capability in that radio, but they haven't really done as much as some people would want. So people, some people like it, some people were a little disappointed. But the 7300 is an excellent radio, and it's almost impossible not to bump into someone on the HF band every hour who just bought a 7300 and they love it. Now, there are other software-defined radios out there. There's Anon Labs, Apache Labs, Anon software-defined radios. I think there's a new one called the 2000D. I lose track. They change the models so frequently. They're all based on Tapper, the Tucson, Arizona Packet Radio Club. And they've been designing software-defined radios for many years. And they design very high-quality stuff, and they write the software for it. And there's a company in India that just kind of packages up for people who don't like to build their own kits. Let me drop them.
JDX, comment?
Yes, Lloyd, comment away.
I'm a proud owner of a 7300, and I've had it for about, I don't know, a year and a half, just when it came out, 2 years maybe, and I find that it's outstanding. And I'm not just saying that. I've done some comparative analysis I have a small SDR receiver. I forgot the Pro, whatever it was. I forgot what the model number. And I'd switch between that and my ICOM 7100 and a variety of wire antennas. And the reception on the 7300 is outstanding. And the fact that it gives you that spectral display is extremely handy. It's touch screen, so you can just touch a high peak immediately and go to a pile up very quickly. And I've got nothing, of course this is standard, but I've got nothing but 5.9s in my audio. So I'm extremely pleased. And certainly, and here's the most important part, for the money, it just can't be beat. I mean, it's like, what is it, $1,200, $1,300 compared to all the other SDRs that are out there that are many, many more times that. So it's just an outstanding rig, and you barely need to read the instruction manuals when you buy it as well. It's just completely intuitive, which is also a fabulous aspect of it. Back to net, K2JVX.
AC2GS. Well, Lloyd, I agree, and you're a perfect example of one of the many very happy customers out there with the ICOM IC7300. The other companies that also sell SDRs, of course, Flex Radio, that makes my Flex 6700. They make the new 6400 and 6600 series that were just starting to be shipped a week ago. They sell some very nice equipment, high-end equipment. It depends what you want. If you want entry level, then the 7300 is great. I really like having 8 receiver slices simultaneously. Now, a lot of people who don't have 8 slices kind of says, what do you really need 8 slices for? It seems rather excessive. But you'd be surprised if you have those 8 slices, you tend to use them all. So 6 of one, half a dozen the other. But even Elecraft, the KX3 and the KX2, is basically a software-defined radio where it's hidden. So there's a lot of design slowly creeping in. I can't think of any of them that are awful. They're all good for different reasons. But as Lloyd said, the 7300 is kind of a great price point for an entry level into software-defined radio. It doesn't give you all the bells and whistles, but that's the whole meaning of entry level.
Roy, I want to ask one question about Elecraft since you brought it up. Is the K3S, is that an SDR as well?
I do not believe so. That's a little bit older model, and I think it uses more legacy components than the KX version, the small one.
Okay, thank you very much. And I just want to ask Lloyd one question, if I may. Were you able to test the 7300 against a traditional HF rig like a 590 SG or a 2000 or TS2000? And what were your findings when you compared it against a more traditional HF rig?
Negative. The only rig I was able to test it against is the 7100, the ICOM 7100, and which isn't bad either, except it's kind of clunky to use. As I said, I forgot the name of that SDR in a box, a receiver. I have to look it up. Pro Labs or something like that, and that is like the latest hot thing, and it was still the 7300 was far superior in its receiving abilities. Back to net.
Yeah, Barry, you know, there's a website called Sherwood that does lists of receiver specs, and you can kind of see the laundry list of the specifications for different receivers and compare them between each other. Also, if you haven't had a chance to look at EHAM, that's always a good place to take a look. I mean, you can't take every single comment for sure. You know, some guys have vested interest in things and others are just cranky. But, again, I have not really heard anyone unhappy with their 7,300 purchase. I have heard people unhappy with other purchases through times and talk about their Achilles heel for one model versus another. But the 7,300 seems to have been a home run for ICOM. They're selling a lot of them, and the price is it seems to be very good.
Okay, Roy, thank you very much. And Lloyd, thank you so much for your input as well. This is KD2MEN, back to Net Control.
Okay, very good, Barry. So once again, if anyone out there has any further questions for the Technical Net, please give me your call sign.
Kilo Delta 2, Mike Delta Victor with a question.
Yes, Eugene, ask your question.
Good evening, Roy, and everyone on net. I have a technical question. I have a dual-band mobile Kenwood Z71 installed in my car, and it's been more than a year. But recently I've noticed it's basically the unit is installed under the seat, and in order to use microphone, which is the RJ45 plug that connects directly to the transceiver, obviously the length would not be enough. So I installed a piece of Cat5 and extended the microphone, and everything's working fine. But recently what I've noticed, which apparently has been there forever, I just didn't pay much attention, there's a bit of ticking in the background anytime I transmit, so like a ticking clock just goes in the background. Not like it's horrible, it's just there. And if I remove the extension cord and plug it in directly, it's completely gone. So there's nothing wrong with that. But anytime I have the extension cord, that ticking noise is there. I've tried to change it to shielded cable. I've tried to run, install a choke and do like four turns, up to five turns, I think I did. But nothing seems to work. No improvement. It just, anytime I have the extension cord, it would have that ticking noise in the background. So the question is, what would be the cause and is there a way to fix it? Back to you, KD2MDV.
AC2GS. I would assume that what's happening is the extra length is allowing some errant RF, the spark circuit, some computer chip that's spewing out a bunch of RF to get into it. And now, what kind of coupler are you using between your connection? I'm not quite sure exactly how you're connecting the microphone. Do you have a coupler between the extra length of RJ45, or did you remove the original RJ45 and replace it with a longer length?
No, I installed, it's only about 3.5, maximum 4 feet, just plain Cat5 with the RJ45 crimp on one end that plugs into transceiver, and I installed a little receptacle on the other end and plugging in original microphone. Nothing was done to the microphone. That just plugs in to the receptacle installed on the other end of Cat5.
Okay. Is the coupler shielded as well?
There is no shield, no. The Cat5 I'm using is not shielded. I've tried to use shielded cable, but no, the receptacle itself is just plain. No, there is no shield.
Okay, what I'm thinking is it's possible that if there's no electrical conduction on the coupler, you're not really grounding the extra segment of the shield, and so you're not really getting the full benefit. What I would suggest just trying as an experiment is one straight length of shielded RJ45 cable with no couplers, no splices, no anything. Just one length of shielded category, I don't know, is it 5+ or 6 these days? And I think you'd have the best bet with that because something's leaking around the edges. And my guess for the most likely place it could leak is that little coupler box that you have attaching the two cables.
Okay, one thing I've tried, which was probably the best as far as shielding, taking a shielded Cat 6, and that was pre-made from factory and had the metal enclosure on the connectors, and I've used a coupler between that and the microphone. So the coupler was not shielded, it's just a plastic enclosure, but that's as far as I've went in terms of shielding. Now, the shield, would it get landed on one of the connectors, one of the connections of the Cat 5 connector, or that's just something that, that would need to be manually bonded with original shield? Well, the thing is, the original shield doesn't get grounded to transceiver because it's just utilizing a standard RJ45, so that's a bit of a confusion. But as far as I've went with shielding, yeah, just a pre-made shielded cable with metal connectors and a plastic coupler between them. Yeah, that's a, that's the best shielding option I've went through.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds reasonable. No, they probably shouldn't be wired to the pin per se. They should probably be grounded to the chassis itself if you could at all kind of do that. But that would be, it sounds like RF is getting somewhere in through the microphone cable, either because the length is just too long and it's just too sensitive, or because you haven't shielded it as much as you can. So again, I would consider doing away with that coupler. Because some couplers are great, but some couplers are less than great. So I would try just going with a single length of RJ45, and you might as well go for a shielded version of it, even if it's not fully grounded. Just if it's rather capacitively coupled to ground, see if it helps. But I would try and get that coupler out of the equation.
So basically what you're suggesting is removing original RJ45 connector from the Kenwood mic and soldering all the connections together, as including shield, and then having RGA connector at the end of that entire thing. Did I understand it correctly?
Well, I thought it was a modular like many hand mics are. There's no RJ45 jack that plugs into the microphone as well. It's all hardwired into the guts.
Yes, there is wire coming out of the mic, and that's non-removable, and then RJ45 at the end. Yes, if I had the RJ45 getting into the mic itself, then yes, I would get a straight piece. But no, it's got the permanent wire coming out of the microphone.
Oh, okay. I mean, that's a bit more work to kind of rewire your microphone. I don't know if you want to do that or not. Most of my microphones, especially the RJ45, the only saving grace that they have, because I think that they're very bad connectors, they have no strain relief, but the one saving grace they usually have is that they're modular on both ends. You can unplug them and replace them at will. But in a perfect world, it would be one single piece of wire. If you feel up to cutting the old wire and soldering the new, then I think that would help. You won't know, unfortunately, unless you try.
Okay, I guess it's worth a try, and in any case, I can always cut it off, the soldering, and just reinstalling your RJ45 connector, so basically I wouldn't hurt the original installation of that cable. All right, that really answers the question. Thank you so much, Ray. I really appreciate it. KD2MDV.
KD2MEN, comment?
Yes, Barry.
Eugene, I just checked the mic. If you pull back the rubber boot, it is another RJ45 connection into the mic. So you might be able to do what Roy's asking you to try. KD2MEN, back to net control.
There we go. That was something I was going to check just to make sure, but I never actually thought of that. I had that radio for over a year, but didn't even know. Thank you so much, Barry.
Yes, thank you very much, Barry. Like I said, the hand mics usually, especially the ones that are RJ45s, that's just the way that they're kind of built. I have a feeling that there's one company in Japan it just kind of makes all the hand mics, because they look an awful lot similar to each other.
Gotcha. Thank you so much, Roy. Thank you.
Okay, very good. So let me throw out once again, anyone else have any kind of questions or comments for tonight's technical net? Okay, let's move on to the tech puzzle. Let's see. The tech puzzle is the question, an antenna is quoted as having a return loss of 12 decibels at its center frequency. The transmission line to the shack has an attenuation of 2 decibels. The return loss measured in the shack will be, choice A is 4 decibels, choice B is 18 decibels, choice C is 14 decibels, and choice D is 16 decibels. So, once again, the return loss of the antenna itself is 12 decibels. The transmission line to the shack has an attenuation of 2 decibels. What would you believe the return loss should be measured by, as, when it reaches the shack?
KY2, and why we'll guess is C14.
Okay, any other people with opinions? Come on, don't be shy. Okay, the problem is that return loss is the ratio of power loss going from the radio to the antenna system and back again. So it's a loop there and back. So you have the 12 decibels from the antenna return loss. The problem is figuring out what to do with the 2 decibel loss in each direction of the transmission line. Since the return loss needs to go in both directions, you have to apply the same 2 decibel loss in two directions. So the total loss from the transmission line is not 2 decibels, it's 4 decibels. So 14 plus 4 is 14 plus, plus 4 is 16. So the answer is D, 16 decibels, because the antenna is 12 decibel loss. The attenuation from the transmission line is both 2 going and coming, which equals 4. So close. It was a trick question. You had to really understand what return loss amounts to. Most people think of it in one direction, but you have to, unfortunately, think of it in two directions.
I knew it was too simple. I didn't think it through.
It's okay. I give you points for at least answering the questions. People don't like to take any chances. I don't know why. It's not like we bite or we do anything nasty. But hopefully we all learn from things. And unfortunately, I do have that tendency to give you a tricky question. Next week's question is going to be incredibly tricky. I'm telling you that up front. So when you read it, don't just immediately figure that you know it. Think about it a while, and then we'll chat about it next time. But that was the TechNet puzzle for tonight. Anyone have any comments or questions or anything about return loss, the puzzle, or anything? Okay, I guess the Olympics wins tonight. Keep in mind, I not only do this technical net, but I do Limark's technical net, and either this Sunday or next Sunday, I think I'm going to be talking about magnets, because I tend to be the physics guy on that tech net. So if you're interested in magnets, check us out on Limark on Sunday night after 8.
Hey, Roy, I got a question.
Yes, Gene.
Last week's technet on Limark, I only caught part of it, but having the radios and cars, they have that much problem with HF and the cars?
It depends. Some people do, some people don't. Cars, unfortunately, tend to generate a lot of RF, and their computer circuits, if not properly shielded, can also be driven quite insane by stray RF. So it depends upon the make and model. Most people don't have that problem because most people were using UHF, VHF, which doesn't seem to be as problematic as HF. You need a special breed of hams to really run around with, you know, something like 500, 600 watts going into 40 meters or something on a car. And you know, the guy at Limark was talking about hooking it up to a 43-foot antenna. I mean, you can imagine how safe it is to drive around with a 43-foot whip on your car.
That's probably I can understand. How can you drive around with a 43-foot whip unless you fold it down horizontally? There's no way vertically you can pass through any overpass.
AC2GS. Well, I think he was simply saying he tested it out without taking the car out. He just kind of plugged it into a wire. It was a whip. I think it was an MFJ fiberglass whip, he said. But, yeah, I mean, I would be, you know, if you want to get a ticket, you just try to run around with a 43-foot whip on your car, even if you bend it over. I mean, unless you're in a truck or something. Where are you going to bend 43 feet?
Nowhere. But it was interesting.
Well, yeah. It was an interesting discussion, and it was interesting of George, KD2FIU, to suggest that the gentleman talk to Citizens Band people. But that's... I don't know. I mean, I probably have gotten a bad... attitude about some Citizens Band people because they kind of go a little bit loosey-goosey with regulations. They tend to juice up amplifiers way beyond the linear aspects, and so they tend to discharge a lot of noise RF on either side. But I'm sure there are diligent Citizens Banders out there somewhere. It's just, I don't know. I think it's problematic to ask Citizens Band people for technical expertise. It's not quite what they're known for.
Sure, that's all the thing. But why would somebody use 40 meters driving? I mean, you have hard enough time getting 40 meters stationary. Being mobile, isn't that much more complicated?
Yes. It is complicated, but it's a different personality entirely. The average ham these days has a nice little mobile radio that they tuck under their dashboard, or they have a handy talkie and they stick a mag mount on the top, and they're on the air on local repeaters. It's a special breed of amateur who sits there with a full-fledged transceiver and even maybe a linear amplifier and generators to maintain the linear amplifier. And some of these guys even have a Morse code key strapped to their leg. So they're sending Morse code as they're driving. I probably, if I was a police officer, I would probably give these poor guys tickets because I couldn't imagine how this would not be distracting. But I've heard you can go on 40 meters. There's East cars, and a lot of that is guys who are mobile, and you'll hear from people driving around doing 40 meters. So is it possible? Yes. I mean, they'll usually use a lot of compromised screwdriver antennas. They don't usually run around with 43-foot whips, but it is a much more technically difficult thing to do than any UHF or VHF operation.
I've seen some of those ham vehicles with a huge screw in the back. The diameter of the load is around like 6 inches. It's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, it requires a singular obsession with the hobby, in my opinion, to really do things like that. I don't quite know, you know, I mean, 40 meters is nice, but you could wait until you get home and then have nice, big, heavy stationary equipment and such. I don't see the need to hook into 40 meters, you know, on the morning drive time. It never struck me as something that's that important. But, you know, again, some guys only, you know, there's a lot of guys who, for them, HF is the only band that's around. They really eschew FM repeaters. They don't really like the higher frequencies. And so for them, it's HF or nothing. And so, you know, again, whatever floats your boat, as long as you don't get into a car accident.
Yeah, sure. It's hobby for everybody, and everybody is a little different.
Yeah. I mean, I got the feeling that that guy asked the question. It was more of a, just an experiment than it was any kind of highly motivated behavior on his part. He just wanted to know the answer as opposed to, I don't think his, you know, if he really, really, really desperately had to. I've known guys who actually trade their cars in so that they have a car that's a little bit less sensitive to RF. Usually these old muscle cars are impervious to such things.
Yeah, they have less computers, you're right.
Yeah, so, I mean, it was a good discussion. I mean, that with the nature of all technical nets, it really is dependent upon the people presenting the questions, what direction the technical nets go into. If they ask interesting questions, hopefully they get interesting responses and they have an interesting tech net. If they don't, then they don't. But before I shut this all down for tonight, let me once again ask if anyone out there would like to submit either a question or a comment for the Kings County Radio Club's technical net tonight.
KD2OMG. KD2OMG, I have a question.
Okay, give me your question.
I'm just curious. I came across a Hallicrafter's SX100 receiver today, and I'm curious to know anybody's experience with that that device and whether it's worth playing around with 40-some-odd pounds of equipment.
Well, I mean, I will ask the people listening. I've just been in this hobby 6.5 years myself, so I really don't have that much experience with boat anchors. Hallicrafter is a highly respected was a highly respected manufacturer of amateur radio equipment, and it's certainly worth, taking a look at seeing if it runs and what it does, but if anyone else has any specific experiences with it, please feel free to push that push-to-talk button. Yeah, I was afraid of that. You might get a better response of boat anchor experiences on the Limemark TechNet because a lot of those guys can be real old-timers. You know, I mean, Dick's been at this for 55 years, and there's a whole bunch of other people been around there for 30, 40 years and such. So, I'm one of those people, good or bad. I looked at my equipment at one point and realized that I have, except for a bird watt meter, no piece of equipment that was built before the year 2000. So Hallicrafters, they're lovely things. They're museum pieces to me, but I unfortunately don't have the room for that. But if you have one, you certainly should kind of take it out for a spin because those things were great in their time, and they're still rather good. There's a lot of people out there who pay good money for Hallicrafter radios.
Well, yeah, I know you have a tendency to enjoy the highest tech, Roy. It's something kind of from my youth, and I'm just sort of tempted to get involved with anything with a lot of analog lights and meters and dials and big knobs. I kind of always had a penchant for that kind of thing. It does seem way less than practical, however.
Well, but one of the things when you get to be a certain age, hopefully, is that you don't have to, your hobbies don't have to make perfect sense. There are guys who dreamed about radios when they were kids. And even though there are less expensive and sturdier and more stable radios today, they still get a kick out of using them. And ultimately, it's the kick that counts. So, you know, if you want to kind of relive your earlier days and that'll help you, as long as you got the room for it and such, like I said before, they're great museum pieces, and people love them to death. They're still in demand for many, many people. I just kind of collect pictures of them, but I understand the allure. There are some people out there who would feel naked if they didn't have stuff that had vacuum tubes flowing in the background.
There is something about the warmth of those heaters glowing, yes.
Yeah, I mean, as far as I'm concerned with hobbies, they don't have to be incredibly rational. They can be emotional. There's a strong emotional component in all of these things. I mean, the ultimate thing that I find the reason why I'm so interested is because I never got over the kind of magical feeling of invisible radio waves being able to cross across the country and into the other side of the world and such. And it's still the closest thing to magic that I still believe in. So that's my excuse for this hobby. And I also like to be on the bleeding edge of all the fancy stuff. But if it wasn't for the allure originally of radio waves, I probably would just be playing with a computer or something.
Okay, well, that's a good opinion. I appreciate that, Roy. Thanks very much.
You're welcome, Alan. Anyway, this is Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra, Roy, and this is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. Does anyone else have any other questions or comments for the Technical Net tonight? Going, going, gone. This net has been brought to you by the Kings County Radio Club. Our club is an ARRL-affiliated club based in Brooklyn, New York. We meet on the first Wednesday of each month. Our next meeting will be Wednesday, March 7th, sometime around 7:30 p.m. We offer a pre-meeting technical question and answer session, much like this net, from 7 p.m. to 8 p.m. as time allows. We have a weekly 2-meter club net on every Tuesday at 9 p.m. on this repeater, as well as a 10-meter net every Sunday at 11 a.m. on 28.380 megahertz upper sideband. This technical net meets on the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month at 9 p.m. We have a weekly net featuring Yaesu's Fusion Digital Technology every Thursday at 9 p.m. on our club repeater KC2RC. If you can communicate using Fusion technology, please join in. We offer an audio stream of the Fusion net on the internet at stream.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow AMs join our club. Keep in mind that an application is available on our website. If you would like to contact the host of this TechNet, simply address your email to tech@kc2rc.com. We maintain an active website at www.kingscountyradioclub.com or www.kc2rc.com, which offers archives of this TechNet, amateur radio news, original articles, and technical forums. Please visit our website and participate. As the great philosopher Jimi Hendrix once said, knowledge speaks, but wisdom listens. So try to listen more and talk a little less. Well, it's time to roll this all up and shut this all down for now, but we'll be back to do it all over again February 28th, and you're all welcome to join us. Thanks to all the guys that participated. Without you guys, I'd just be talking to myself. So this is Roy, AC2GS, going clear and getting the heck out of here. Until next time, guys.
All right, 73, Kilo Yankee 2, Michael Yankee out.
KD2OMG, Ellen, over and out.
Good session, Roy. Good session. Good night to everybody on the net. KD2MEN.